Support comes from Columbia Acura, offering a complete selection of new and pre-owned luxury cars. Columbia Acura's new vehicle lineup and professional staff are available 7 days a week on Montgomery Road at I-275. More information at 530-0100 or ColumbiaAcura.com. Columbia Acura, precision crafted performance.
The debates have begun, finding it hard to keep track of the candidates, the campaigns, the issues, the drama. Morning Edition can help, with a sharp focus on the race towards 2020. And if all the politics has you feeling dizzy, don't worry. You still get a steady dose of science, technology, the arts, and human interest stories from around the world. Find your perfect balance with Morning Edition from NPR News.
On 91.7 WVXU, with host Marianne Zalesnik.
Support comes from sustaining members like you and LG&E. The weather can impact your energy bills. KU is empowering you to save with no and low-cost tips. Information is available online at lge-ku.com/tips. That's lge-ku.com/tips.
Support comes from Water Tower Fine Wines across from the Water Tower in Mount Washington, sharing their passion for wine. The next Sunday sampler, Bold White's Europe versus New World on August 18th, will taste a curated selection of 9 wines, and Chef Jan will have food to complement the wines. Reservations required at 231-9463.
Support comes from the UC Center for Business Analytics presenting Introduction to Tableau, August 22nd and 23rd. Designed for beginner Tableau users and anyone who works with data with or without technical or analytical backgrounds. Experienced users can also benefit from this training. Registration at business.uc.edu/Tableau or 556-5710.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Cincinnati Reds are celebrating their sesquicentennial this season. That's the 150th anniversary of the club. And in that time, more than 20,000 games have been played. Which ones come to your mind as ranking among the greatest games in Reds history? Two authors and longtime Reds fans and enthusiasts, Joe Heffron and Jack Heffron, ranked the 50 greatest in their new book, Classic Reds, the 50 Greatest Games in Cincinnati Reds History. And joining us now is one of the authors, Jack Heffron. He's on the phone with us. Welcome, Jack.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to do that. You know, we've been emailing back and forth to set up this segment, and I realize now that I failed to ask a very obvious question, and that is, what is your relation to Joe? Are you brothers, father, son?
Brothers.
Your brothers. All right. So two brothers worked on this book together, and Jack, the Reds have played a ton of games, more than 20,000 of them, so I'm just curious, how did you all begin to even narrow this down?
I think we started with the ones that, you know, were kind of no-brainers, you know, Pete Rose breaking the hit record, Tom Browning's perfect game, the World Series victories, you know, all of those, you know, had to be in there. But it certainly was a challenge to, kind of figure out once you started into the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was, well, I guess we're going to have to leave this one out. One thing we did to allow us to kind of talk about more games is we would pick one game per World Series and playoff series. So, you know, everybody thinks, oh, game six of the 1975 series against the Red Sox, which the Reds actually lost, but would be number one because it's certainly considered one of the great games in major league history. But we talked about that game within the context of game seven of that series, which the Reds won. And, we picked that one as actually the greatest game.
How long did you work on this?
I would say maybe 18 months, something like that. I mean, Joe and I had written another book about the Reds called The Local Boys, Hometown Players for the Cincinnati Reds. And I've edited quite a few books on the Reds, from, you know, Greg Rhodes's books, to book on the 1990 Reds, the 2010 Reds. So, I mean, I came in with a pretty good working knowledge of you know, where to find information and what would be probably the, you know, certainly ones that would have to be on the list.
Well, you can imagine that diehard Reds fans may have some disagreements with the order in which you place these games.
we've heard those already.
I'm curious if you and your brother decided these rankings by yourselves. Did you seek any outside perspective? Was it just the two of you?
We did. We argued amongst ourselves, and then sent our list out to a number of other Reds fans and local sports writers who kind of chimed in, and then we collected all of their feedback, and then we were moving the, even when we were in the proofing stage, of the finished manuscript, we were still flipping some of the numbers around. But I think other than say the top 10, a lot of it really, it's when we say greatest games, we defined that as the most historically significant games. We're trying to kind of, I guess, tell the history of the Reds, you know, this glorious 150-year history through 50 games. So we kind of wanted to make sure that every decade, you know, had at least a game, and we could use that story of the game to kind of speak in larger terms about what was going on with the Reds at that time. So, yeah, just like Local Boys was a sort of history of the Reds through local guys who had played for the team, Classic Reds is a history of the Reds seen through the prism of 50 games.
And this is the 150th anniversary of the Reds this season. It's not a great season. It's had some good moments, though. I'm wondering if you've seen anything this season that could make its way into an updated version of this book someday.
Was there, say, a great game this year? Well, we're still hopeful. You know? and the fact that we can be hopeful and going into the second week of August is a nice change from, say, the past 4 or 5 years when, you know, things were pretty dismal by the All-Star break. Certainly I think if they could, you know, win a get a wild card, which is, you know, somewhat remote, but not out of the realm of possibility, we might have to kind of slip one into the next edition. But I don't know who we'd take out, because once we got down to 50, I really, you know, felt strongly about every single game.
Well, before we jump into those games that you've ranked, I'm curious, you know, we've had a few guests on since I started here in February with authors who've put out books or are offering some type of lecture on the Reds. What is it about the Cincinnati Reds that keeps its fans so dedicated, even now, after so many lackluster seasons this century?
I think it has a lot to do with the culture of the city itself and, how the Reds are just so woven into that culture. It's not even so much about wins and losses and, you know, who's going to start the game tonight. It really, you know, has to do with the kind of cultural identity of the city. We all, you know, grow up the Reds are, as Cincinnati as anything you can name. Where even the Bengals, who have had to some extent more success, you know, certainly like say in the, you know, the past 10, 15 years, somehow it isn't sort of woven into the fabric of the culture the way the Reds are. And so I think, people just grow up with it, and, you know, kids in their teens have rarely seen the Reds be any good. You know, certainly older people, you know, could remember the 1990 series or the Big Red Machine and, you know, kind of use that legacy to keep them inspired. But, it's fun going down to the ball games and seeing, you know, little kids 5, 10 years old with all of their Red stuff. It really, it's kind of like who we are as Cincinnatians.
And so you've got these top 50 games that you've accumulated. And I noticed as I was reading through it that most of these happened before I was born. I'm going to be 40 next year. So 13 of these games have happened in my lifetime, meaning since 1980. So I guess to start exploring the games that you ranked, I'm going to be selfish and talk about at least one of those that happened that I certainly remember. And I'll note that while we're talking about the rankings and revealing some of that, it's sort of the stories behind the games that make this book worth picking up. So I hope the audience doesn't feel like we're giving too much away here. And ranking at number three is the wire-to-wire run of the Reds to the World Series title in 1990. I remember that fifth grade, we were learning about fractions and we were going to color in the pieces of the pie depending on whether it was going to be red or green for the Athletics. And it was just not much of an exercise because it was all red. The Reds ran the table on the A's that year. Talk about that and why you ranked it so high.
I think certainly because any world championship, unfortunately, in that 150 years, we haven't had a whole lot of those. So, it was certainly up there for that reason. But then I think also just because the Reds were such underdogs. They played the Oakland A's, who were heavy favorites. Who had Dave Stewart was their great ace, and in the first game, and he was this glowering, very menacing type of presence on the mound, and Eric Davis hit that home run, and suddenly we all thought, wow, maybe we can really play with these guys. And then to just beat them so convincingly, that was certainly a great moment in all of the 150 years. It really was, and that was a special team. You had Lou Piniella, and certainly Eric Davis was the big star of the team. Jose Rijo. They got off to a fast start, ran the table on the National League, and then went into the World Series. Everybody thinking, "Oh, Oakland's going to just walk all over them," and just the opposite happened. So yeah, I think we in Cincinnati were pretty happy about that one.
And that was the last World Series the Reds have won. It's been almost 30 years. And while you were working on this book, I'm wondering if you saw any patterns emerging from more successful eras that you think could be adopted now to put that team back as title contenders.
Certainly, in the, during their great years in the 60s and the 70s, free agency was just coming in during that time. Being a small market, you could still keep a team like the Big Red Machine together. Although once free agency started in the late 70s, they did slowly kind of dismantle it. And the way Major League Baseball is designed today, it's really tough for a small market to have any kind of sustained success. It has to be almost this cycle of being really bad, getting some good draft choices, developing those guys, making some smart trades, and then you have what's called the window of maybe 3 or 4 years where you can be really good, and then you have to start all over. Whereas the market like Chicago or New York or LA, they can pretty much sustain success, year after year. They might have a down year now and again, but for a market like Cincinnati, unless there is some kind of salary cap or something that's instituted, it's tough to be kind of consistently good. So we had that window in 2010, 2011, 2012, and then those players were kind of gradually traded off, and the new ones are coming in, and they seem to be coming up now. There's an awful lot of exciting young players on the Reds team, but boy, everything has to come together in order to have that window of success.
All right, let's go to October 6, 1995, and you rank this game as number 21 in Reds history. This was a divisional series game against the LA Dodgers, the playoffs, 95.
Right.
And you set this game up by explaining how the Reds had been victims of the strike that happened the season prior and delayed the start of 95. And also, they were victims of the strike in 1981 as well. Tell us about the bad timing of strikes and the impact it's had on those respective Red seasons.
Yeah, I mean, 81 in a way was even worse because the Reds actually had the best one-loss record in the game that year. But because of the strike, they basically just Major League Baseball decided to kind of break the season in half. And the team that had the most victories in the first half played the team that had the most victories in the second half. And even though the Reds over the course of the season had more than either of those teams, they hadn't won either first or second half, and so they didn't get into the playoffs. So, yeah, that was a real shame. And that really was sort of the last gasp of what, you know, might be called the Big Red Machine. Then, you know, through the early into the mid-80s, you know, things really kind of went downhill. The 1995, a great year. I mean, and that was a really good team. You know, that was sort of the Barry Larkin team, who, and, you know, because we love our local boys. I think that one stands out especially, as a strong one. And then to beat, you know, the hated Dodgers, and even to beat Hideki Nomo, who was, kind of the big ace that year and the one who was kind of getting all the accolades. And to do it so convincingly, they won that game 10-1. And, of course, then, you know, went on. And, of course, that was the era of the great Braves pitching. With Maddox and Glavine, so they didn't get to the series, but that was a special special victory for them. And frankly, it's the last playoff series that they won. So yeah,
I noticed that you ranked number 23, a game between the Reds and the Braves from July 31, 1978. It's titled "The Hit Streak," and I want to read the very first paragraph of this for our listeners.
Okay.
Most baseball fans know about Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak in 1941. It's one of those legendary records in the history of the game, a number that needs no explanation. Far fewer fans today know who holds the modern era's all-time consecutive game hitting record in the National League. That would be Pete Rose of the Cincinnati Reds. So we know Pete as the Hit King because he has the most hits ever. But this was something that I didn't really know either. So you called it out correctly. He also has this notation of consecutive game hitting record, and it happened on July 31st, 1978 against the Braves. Tell us about it.
That summer, certainly in Cincinnati, but really, you know, nationally, especially once he had gotten, you know, into the 30s, which is, you know, very rare. Rose, he was determined to get that National League, and I guess he was, you know, hoping to break DiMaggio's record, and was furious in that game because, especially on his last at bat, the Braves reliever Gene Garber was just not throwing him any strikes at all. And of course Rose had to swing at something. I mean, if he walked, this streak still would have been broken. So he was just really incensed that, you know, he felt like, you know, kind of cheated, that the Braves had decided, you know, we're just not going to give him anything to hit. He can walk every time, but he's not going to get the streak ends tonight. You can kind of understand it, but at the same time, you know, they were certainly under no obligation to, throw him hittable strikes that where he could continue it. But that was just another, I think, amazing record by Rose. And he was just such a one-of-a-kind guy, and he just lived for statistics and all of that. So, you know, he was loving it. And while a lot of players might have been eventually distracted by it or not really liking all the media attention. Rose ate it up. He just, you know, he wanted everybody talking about Pete Rose.
What did you learn that you didn't know before, even though you've written about the Reds for a long time? But was there something that, as you were compiling this, that stood out to you as something that was new?
Actually, one of my favorite stories.
And we got about 30 seconds.
The guy who threw the first no-hitter for the Reds was the only pitched two games. This was in the 1890s. His name was Bumpus Jones.
Nice.
And his story is like something out of a 1940s Jimmy Stewart movie, that how this guy would somehow picked to pitch this one game, and he pitched a no-hitter, and then that was pretty much the end of his career.
You'll be able to read about that and other great stories in the 50 Greatest Games in Cincinnati Reds History. It's part of Classic Reds, written by Joe Heffron and Jack Heffron. We've been talking to Jack Heffron on the phone. Jack, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Michael, thank you. I really appreciate it. Take care.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. President Trump visits shooting victims in Dayton and then takes to Twitter to attack local officials. Allegations of misconduct against a priest bring more questions from parishioners to the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and the parent company of the Cincinnati Inquirer may be sold. What does that mean for the local paper of record? We discuss it in the Friday News Review tomorrow at noon on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.